We've talked about various particle interactions with matter. At the very beginning, we talked about different kinds of applications that we'll have in particle physics in terms of different kinds of analysis you'll do, different kinds of particles you need to find, what the properties of those particles are. But then we studied particle interactions of matter for charged electromagnetically interacting particles, neutral electromagnetically interacting particles, basically a photon, strongly interacting particles, and weakly interacting particles. And then we've sort of started using the two large groups of common detector in particle physics, trackers, which measure momenta, and calorimeters, which measure energy. Obviously, we're very preoccupied with getting the kinematic information of the particles in our events. However, that's not all of it. We need to know in some way, shape, or form what kind of particle we have. If we know what kind of particle we have, it allows us to understand the event more properly. It allows us to determine what kinds of interactions the event is actually showing us. And without that information, a lot of ambiguity comes out. So we really need to know what kind of particle. Part and parcel with that information is what is the mass of the particle, okay? And what is the electrical charge of the particle? And one could also argue, what is the color charge of the particle, or of its, more importantly, of its constituents? So there's some information about these particles that we care about. So, you know, we could talk about four really gross categories of particle. We could talk about electromagnetically interacting leptons. They interact by the weak interaction, but it's really not noticeable because the interaction with their charge is so strong. There's neutral particles, pi zeros and photons, and eta particles. We also talked about neutrons. There's charged hadrons. These interact electromagnetically with a detector, but they also interact by the strong interaction. And then there's weakly interacting particles like neutrinos and perhaps neutralinos or things like that in some new models like supersymmetry. So we want to know what type of particle we're dealing with and what category that lands in. It's very important to understand the processes that we're looking at. All right. Now, each species has some unique combination, and we could talk about this in a different ways, but it really comes down to charge, mass, and the kind of interaction it can engage in. As I said, strong, electromagnetic, or weak. And these three pieces of information, I mean, we only have a certain number of particles out there. There's not a continuum of particles. So there's, for instance, a large gap between electron mass and the next lightest particle, the muon. There's quite a big gap there. So we want to have some constraints on the particle such that we can figure out which one of those it is. So if we know the momentum or the energy of a particle, then if we measured, for instance, the relativistic beta of the particle, we would have its mass, okay? If we looked in an ionization detector and we saw ionization from the passage of a particle, we would know it had electrical charge. We might not know how much charge it had or what the sign was, but we would at least know that there was electric charge or there was not. Likewise, if we knew the electrical charge and perhaps the total energy of a particle or momentum, we still might not know everything. For instance, a muon and a pion are very similar in mass, but they interact very differently with matter. And so looking at shower properties, does the particle produce an electromagnetic shower, a hadronic shower, or not shower at all when it goes through a whole bunch of material, that is going to tell us something about whether it is, for instance, a muon, an electron or photon, or a hadron. Those are three clear groupings in terms of looking at showers. So we'll talk about each of those applications. Well, there's sort of a useful basic example that's a little more specific in Gruppen and Schwarz at the beginning of chapter. I think it's chapter 8. So let's just imagine you had a tracker and you measured the radius of curvature, rho. So, you know, you have some particle that's being bent in a magnetic field. Well, that radius of curvature is proportional to the magnitude of the momentum divided by the charge z of the particle. And so then that equals this. So it's got the mass of the particle in it, the velocity, and the charge. These are the three, basically, parameters that we can know about this particle. Now, we could also use, we'll look at these a little bit. We can measure how long the particle takes to travel a certain distance. Okay? That tells us its velocity. So the time is inversely proportional to the velocity or beta of the particle. We could also, this isn't quite right, this should be cosine of theta, sorry. But we can also look at Cherenkov radiation, and by depending on the angle of emission of that radiation, we have another way of constraining beta, okay? The time of flight tends to work at lower momenta, the Cherenkov at higher, but in any case, you can come up with a measurement of beta. So now you have two pieces of information and three unknowns. And then you could also use another device, for instance, a calorimeter, and you can measure the energy of the particle. And that, of course, is a function of the velocity or gamma and the mass. So now what you have is you have three pieces of information and relations, and you have three unknowns, the mass, the charge, and something related to the velocity. And so you can basically get all three of the pieces of information that you need. Now, you may not, one thing that's worth saying, like, for instance, here, let's talk about the Cherenkov, use of Cherenkov. You may have a very relativistic particle, and beta may basically be 1, okay? So you may really not know exactly what the velocity is. It's too high for you to measure it. But what you know is it's above some value. And that may be able just enough to be able to rule out some types of particles. Okay. So, for instance, that might rule out more massive particles, which at that momentum would be traveling a lot more slowly. Okay. So you don't necessarily have a measurement of the velocity. You may not have an amazingly precise measurement of the time of flight, but you have a constraint. You have a piece of information that allows you to say, okay, this is at least not consistent with this possibility. So therefore, I must have this type of particle. I must have an electron and not a pion. Okay? So that's what particle ID is about. It's not about measuring these parameters exactly. It's about putting limits on them such that you know, okay, it's this, not this. So to take that a little more further, let's just sort of graphically, let's consider a muon and a pion. Well, the masses of the muon and pion are very similar. Like a muon is 106 MeV, a pion is 140, and their charges are identical, okay? However, if you put a slab of material in their path, the muon will just travel through. It just interacts by ionization. It's too massive to produce an electromagnetic shower, okay? But it's not a hadron, so it doesn't interact with the nuclei, aside from just with their charge. So it just goes right by. It just goes through. So you just see an energy loss per distance that's within some tens of percent of a minimum ionizing particle. A pi minus, however, will It interacts with its charge, certainly, but it will interact with the nucleus as well. And it will go through a hadronic shower, just like we talked about before. So even though these particles have very similar charge and very similar mass, they clearly behave very different in the differently in the detector. This is several absorption lengths, for instance. Okay, so we could tell these two apart, in this case, by using a calorimeter. Now, we can say, well, okay, let's take another situation, a photon and an electron. Their masses are obviously different, but in a calorimeter, when they strike a calorimeter, when they shower, they look awfully similar. The photon has a slightly different depth to its shower, but they look very similar. So the way that you can tell that, well, what's the difference? The difference is that the electron has an electric charge. It will leave ionization, and the photon will not. So if you put a tracking device in the path of this particle before you destroy it in your calorimeter, you can then clearly distinguish these two cases. So you can use, in these two examples, you're using detectors that we've already talked about, tracking or calorimetry, but they now have aspects to them that allow you to discriminate particle type A from particle type B. Okay? So it's not just using some of the effects I've already warned you were for particle ID, like Cherenkov radiation, transition radiation, time of flight. It's also using some of the technologies that you've already seen. So let's talk about, let's consider the first one I just mentioned, which is time of flight. So this is one of the most obvious things you might think of doing. I want to know the velocity. Let's measure its velocity. I need to measure across some distance how long it took to go between two points. So this works for low momentum particles. And as we said, it can be used to identify a particle's mass if we know the particle's momentum. So imagine you had, real simple detector, you have two scintillators some distance L apart, okay? And you have some particle that's traveling with some velocity V between these two points, and it will strike them at times T1 and T2. So the difference between these times is just the distance L divided by the velocity, and we call that the time of flight. I'll just abbreviate it TOF to be short. Now, comparing this for two different particles, this is what we want to do for particle ID. Now, we don't have in my particular event, you know, a pion and a kaon, and we compare them. That's not what happens. What happens is you have a reference idea of what, say, a pion looks like. Okay? You may do that in a variety of ways. It may be using test beam, as we talked about. It may be other events in your data sample. But you have an idea of what, because you have to calibrate your detector. You have to understand precisely what its timing resolution is and things like that. So you want to measure in your samples what does a pion do and what does a kaon do, for instance, or what does a pion do and what does a proton do. So you have to get some sense for how your detector behaves, but you're implicitly comparing one particle to another. So call them particle type A and particle type B. So the difference in time... So this is not the difference in time to travel. This is the difference in time of flight between what a particle, a pion, say, would take, particle of type A, versus the time of flight that a particle of type B, say, a kaon, would take. Okay? So this delta T is a difference in the time of flights. Okay? You're comparing what a typical kaon, say, would look like versus a typical pion. And if the typical differences are large enough compared to your timing resolution, you can identify these particles. Okay? If I can measure my times to within 100 picoseconds, and a pion and a kaon are different by 500 picoseconds, I'm in good shape. I can separate them. I can say, well, this is five times bigger than my resolution. I definitely see a difference in the time of flight of this particle compared to, say, a kaon. So it's not a kaon. It must be a pion. Okay? So if you just go through the time of flights are given up here. So you have L over C times 1 over B sub A, beta sub A minus 1 over beta sub B. You can simplify this a little bit using the PC equals beta times the energy. Okay. Now, each of these energies, and I won't do it, but each of these energies is, of course, the quadratic sum of the momentum term plus a mass term. So the kinetic energy term plus the rest energy term. So this thing makes this a little bit more complicated, but you can expand these square roots that are involved in here and then use the fact that the momentum is much larger than the mass term in most cases. So that allows you to simplify this delta T expression to be LC over 2P squared times a difference in masses. So this is nice. If you measured a delta T, you basically have a mass measurement, okay, just directly. You know the geometry of your particles, L. Presumably you have some way, maybe a tracker, that tells you the momentum, P. So now you have directly a mass measurement, okay? And one thing that's important to point out about this is that it's proportional to 1 over P squared. So it drops very rapidly. And that's a problem because at some point, the size of this time of flight difference is going to be smaller than your resolution. So, you know, just to see what that looks like, see if I can find it. Yeah, so this okay. Can you see that? So this is a pion minus a proton. So this is doing the delta T calculation for a pion minus a proton. And this is normalized to the length of the detector. So this is a general plot. So this is comparing a pion to a proton. Now this is the biggest. We've got a pion, a kaon, and a proton in these plots. This is the biggest mass difference, and so you see the largest difference at any given momentum, P. The kaon minus pi, proton is the next largest mass difference. That's about a half a GeV difference, and you see it's a little smaller. And then the pion minus the kaon, this is about 0.36 MeV, 0.36 GeV difference. And so you see this has the smallest difference of all of them, and you can see that it falls down very quickly, right? So we're only up to a few GeV here, and we're getting to some pretty small numbers per unit length. Okay, this is in terms of picoseconds per meter. So 50 picoseconds. Time-of-flight detectors have been built to be sensitive to these kinds of resolutions, 10 to 100 picoseconds. The best one I've ever heard of is about 5 picoseconds. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. Okay, so there are a couple of different ways you could do it. We just talked about sort of a scintillator configuration, very simple. You have two pieces of scintillator. Scintillator makes sense because in a scintillator case, you have, as we've said, the scintillation light can, depending on the material, can arrive very quickly. If you had a plastic scintillator, you can get a scintillation pulse within 1 or 2 nanoseconds of when you get it. And if you have a pulse that happens around 1 nanosecond, the precision of your measurement and the peak of the pulse can be a fraction of that. So it's pretty straightforward to get a fraction of a nanosecond time resolution using scintillators. And if you were to consider a case where you had two scintillators about a meter apart and they had a resolution of about 0.1 nanoseconds, then you could do pi k separation up to about a GeV. That would mean at a GeV, the timing difference of those two particles would be about 400 nanoseconds, so four times the timing resolution. Okay? So this, we're talking about pretty low momentum particles. Now, if I made the detector bigger, say 10 meters, now the timing difference is 4 nanoseconds. That's really easy to measure. But what that really means is you can go to several GeV, maybe 10 GeV, if you really wanted to do that. But you've got a 10-meter detector. It's a big detector. So that's a disadvantage. Now, another way that you can do this, and we didn't talk about this for tracking, but it's actually one of the offshoots of those detectors that we talked about with drift chambers and things like that. It's called a spark chamber, but this can be used for timing. And you could say, well, you know, Bob, why would you do that? Anything that uses gases is going to be really slow. How are you going to get a useful timing measurement in that situation? Well, what you can do is you can crank up the high voltage on the detector and set it up so that basically we talked a little bit about the fact that when you look at when you look at the kind of ionization that you get out of a gas detector, you had this plot that looked, you may remember, kind of like this. You remember this plot? Okay. And we said that in the proportional region, it was sort of in this area. There was a Geiger counter region way up here where you apply the voltage, a very high voltage, such that when a particle passed through, it just discharged. Okay, you've heard these detectors just go, you know, for radiation or whatever. So as you go up to higher and higher voltages, things we don't have a, this is the proportional regime, proportional chamber case. Okay, we talked about where the ionization is proportional to the energy of the particle. But here, you have a situation where things are less stable, because what happens is that when the particle produces some ionization, it quickly causes an avalanche, and then you get a discharge. You get the phrase that the book, which I find is amusing, is a conducting plasma channel, which is basically a spark. Okay? All right? That's all that is. So it's a lightning bolt. Okay? So all of a sudden, there's a conducting path between the electrodes, and that happens very fast. And so even though drift times are very slow, you're not really limited by the drift time. You're limited by the fact that you have a sudden current, and it's a large current, and it happens very suddenly. Okay? Now, in your electronics, you're going to convert that to a change in voltage, but the point is that you're not really worried anymore now about a drift time. You're worried about what you're seeing is a big change in voltage, and we don't really care what happens down here. You care about this. You say, well, once this gets above some level, or once the rate of change of the voltage gets above some level, okay, I just trigger on that. I don't even care how big it is. I just want to know that this voltage is its derivative is high enough. And you say, okay, fine. And you have a time measurement. So you see this in your first detector, and then you do it again. So imagine you have a particle, and instead of passing through two scintillators, we're passing through two spark chambers. And so we get a discharge here, and we get a discharge here, and we measure the times of those discharges as the leading edge of this sudden current, and so we get a T1 and a T2. It's not the time of the peaked scintillation light that we would get if we were using scintillation. It's basically when the current starts to arrive. We didn't even wait for all of the current to occur. But what this is so sudden that you can get very, very small time measurements with a good resolution. Okay? So now there is also a version of this called a resistive plate chamber, and I wouldn't normally go into details, but these, a lot of experiments have used these more recently, and so I wanted to at least mention them. So they're kind of similar to a spark chamber. It's just that you don't cause the discharge. You don't cause the spark to happen. However, you still get a large increase in current, because you have an avalanche, you still get a large increase in current. And again, you don't wait for all this drift time. You just take, there will be a long drift time here. You don't really care about that. What you care about is this time versus the time for the second detector. Okay? So that's using timing measurements for particle ID. Anybody have any questions about that before I talk about ionization? No? Okay. So, all right, let's now go to a totally different approach, which is that we spend a lot of time talking about how particles produce ionization and what the properties of that ionization are. So let's just think about a basic drift chamber, okay? So you have your two electrodes here and here. These would be cathodes. You have some anode wires here. A particle passes through. It produces some ionization. The ions drift to the wires, and then they'll avalanche near the wires, as we talked about. But you'll get some signal, which is proportional to the number of ionization electrons that were produced. And there's a voltage difference here, so everything drifts to the wires. Okay, so that's basically the drift detector that we talked about before. Now, we also talked about the beta block function, where you have, this should say DEDX, but you have your energy loss per distance, okay? And for low momenta, it falls very rapidly. It goes to a minimum, which we call the minimum ionization point, and then it rises slowly at high momentum, and it sort of flattens out. So if you remember, we call this the relativistic rise. Excuse me. And this flattening out is due to the density of the material. The density effect causes it to flatten out. And so a denser material actually flattens out quicker. And the size of this overall change is smaller. Okay? Now, this drawing is a really lame attempt of mine to draw the beta block function for a few different particles. Okay? So the dark line is for a charged pion, okay? This dashed line near it is a charged muon, and it's very close to it because the mass of the muon is basically almost the same as a charged pion. So if you put in the numbers, you'd only get a tiny difference between the two. But if you put in another particle here, say a kaon, the kaon mass is different. So at a given momentum, you have a different velocity, et cetera, et cetera. You end up with a different ionization, okay? And you can imagine if you knew the momentum of the particle, so you knew you were right here, all right? If you measured a ionization level that was around here, you would know that you had a pion or a muon. If you measured an ionization level that was around here, you would know you had a kaon, okay? And that's the basic idea behind using ionization for particle ID. All right? And I'll show some table and some drawings of this in a second, but I'll finish the slide first. Now, the big issue here, if you're going to use the relativistic rise for particle ID, the relativistic rise is not that big. Okay? The biggest it could be is maybe 50 or 60% from the bottom here, the minimum ionization point. So, and you're going over orders of magnitude of momentum. This is a logarithmic plot. So you can go from 1 GeV to 100 GeV. That's two orders of magnitude. And your ionization loss may only change by 20%. That's not that much, especially when you consider how wide the ionization distribution is, which we'll talk about. So this is not a very big effect. But there are ways, which we'll talk about how you can make that measurement very good, and you can discriminate even just a few percent change. So if I measure it and I get a number that's a few percent different than what a kaon would be, I may know I have a muon in this case, or a pion. Now, of course, the size of this relativistic rise is important. And, excuse me, the choice of gas matters. If you remember, the beta block function was a function of Z. It had some properties, the ionization potential of the material, I. So it had information that was specific to each material. So picking the right material makes sense, but the other thing is the density matters. So you may want to use a gas detector because a gas detector doesn't have the density effect. The size of this variation may be bigger than it would be if you had, say, a semiconductor detector. Okay? So you have to consider that. So an example is for argon-methane mixture. Over three orders of magnitude in momentum, from 100 MeV to 100 GeV. It's a huge range in momentum. Okay, there's completely different physics going on here and here. And yet, in terms of dEdx, the relativistic rise only goes up by 50%. Okay? So it's hard to detect it. Now, you want to maximize the difference in dEdx. You want to maximize how much different this particle looks than this particle. You want to produce a situation where these two measurements are as different as possible and it well measured, so the resolution is really good. So we'll call that difference D. It's basically a difference in dEdx's. Okay? And gaseous detectors have a smaller density, and that's why they give a larger D. Okay? And, as I said, it's very hard to separate a pion and a muon because they're at the same momentum. They don't have much difference in mass, and D is too small. But basically what we talk about is a resolving part where you have D over the resolution of the detector, sigma. Okay? So let's look at some distributions to make this a little more concrete. So first, well, let's remind ourselves of what these look like. So this is, if you can see it, here we have a muon and a pion. They're right next to each other. So you see this is dEdx. So this is the this is the energy loss. And this is the momentum. And you see for a given momentum, the pion and the muon are very close to each other, very hard to separate. Kaon is down here, and a proton is down here. So maybe I could separate these two from a kaon or a proton. And the electron is way up here, okay? This is all relative to the minimum ionization level. So this is 1.0 by construction, okay? So that's what they look like. And again, you're taking a slice of this in the vertical direction. You want to see this measurement be different than this measurement or this measurement, okay? Now, the actual ionization distributions are really wide. So at a given momentum, I forget, this is at 50 GeV, this is what a kaon looks like. And this is what a pion looks like. Now, they're really wide. Okay, you can see this is ranging from about 2.3 up to about 3 or 3.5. So it's about a 50% measurement. It's really a wide distribution. And you can see that a lot of this kaon distribution overlaps this pion distribution. They're not well separated. Okay? This is just a schematic diagram. This is an actual distribution from a working detector. And then you have these Landau tails from delta rays or whatever that produce large energy losses every once in a while. And so you just get these large overlaps. Now you can see that the kaon is lower than the pion. If I took 1,000 events and I saw 500 things with a peak here and 500 with peaks here, I would be able to see that there were two separate peaks. But on a case-by-case basis, I couldn't tell very easily. And the fact that the kaon is lower is just because on the y-axis, this curve at a given momentum is lower than this curve. Okay? Now, and this is just actual data showing versus momentum the DEDX. So we had looked at this some time ago, but you see the muon and the pion are very close to each other, and then the kaon and the proton, and this is actually a D meson, and this is an electron. But you could see if you're down here, you could separate these. If you get way up here at a very high energy, it becomes pretty tough. So it depends on where you are. In this region, it's not so easy. So, okay. Okay. So these Landau fluctuations are a major problem. So if you're going to do a particle identification, an attempt to identify what particle that you have to somehow deal with this. They range from 30% to 100%, meaning that if I have a distribution, whatever this mean is, mu, that the width, let's say the full width half maximum, is 30% to 100% of the mean. So you're talking about, 2 plus or minus 1 or 2 plus or minus 2. So so what that means is because the distributions overlap, because these distributions overlap, it's actually very inefficient for me to tell one particle from another. If I want to say, okay, everything below 1.8 is a kaon, and everything above that is a pion, well, mostly I would be right in this case. But I'd lose, 20% of my kaons and probably 20% of my pions. It would be very inefficient, not the best way to go. You want to make these distributions as narrow as possible. So to do that, there's a few things that you could do to do that. So one thing is to keep in mind, keep the density low, so the size of the relativistic rise is as big as it can be. You could also change the pressure so that the amount of gas that you go through is a little larger. You have to be a little careful, again, because of the density. But if you're within a few atmospheres, you'll be fine. The main thing is to take the ionization and measure it many times. So you take a particle and you pass it through several layers of drift chambers, for instance. And so, you have here, You have one plane, you have another plane, and you can just imagine doing this many times. You do 100 times. This improves the resolution because you get more and more information. And so each measurement may have a lot of fluctuations, but taking their average reduces them. Okay? But you still have the problem that you have delta rays, and these will all of a sudden, some fraction of them will give you just a much larger amount of energy. And that still is a reason that you get an overlap of the distributions. Okay? So the big difficulty becomes out here in the tail, very hard to get rid of that because that's just due to physics, due to Landau fluctuations. Now, one of the ways to address that is you could say, well, I'll throw away in these several measurements, I'll throw away the highest energy, the layers that have the highest losses, that recorded the highest losses. Okay, I'll just say, well, you know, about 30% of the time I produce a delta ray, so I'll throw away the highest 30% of the ionization measurements. And that will disproportionately throw away those delta ray fluctuations. It will reduce that tail. Okay? And then you can take the average of what's left. So you still have your other 70% of your measurements, or 50%. You may throw away 50% of your measurements. But then you take the average of what's left, and you will still get some improvement. And there are detectors that have actually gotten to the point where the sigma, the distribution, is about a few percent wide. Okay? So that's pretty incredible, given the fluctuations. And it kind of goes as 1 over the square root of the number of samples, number of measurements that you made, because it's kind of statistical. It is statistical. Okay, I won't get into that. Okay? Now, the problem, there are some problems with this, okay? If you throw away, and this is the first time we'll do this, and I'll try to interleave this through later lectures as well, where we'll talk a little bit about an analysis technique, okay? So we're starting to get to a sophisticated level in the experimental apparatus now in the semester, where we can talk about, well, how would I do an analysis that would really maximize what I can do? I don't just need to talk about wires and detector hardware. I can talk about, well, how can I take these measurements and get the best possible number? Okay? Well, one way is to consider these weaknesses. First of all, when you throw away those 30 or 50% of your measurements, you're throwing away information. You're throwing away 30% of all your measurements. You're throwing away 30% of your detector, or 50%. And some of those layers actually just didn't have Landau fluctuations. Some of them did. But in any case, it's information. The other thing is that you're biasing your measurement. Now you're getting a distribution that isn't really the physical distribution. That may be kind of hard to understand what it should look like. So one way to get around this, okay, is to use all the information more carefully. And this discussion occurs at this point in Gruppen and Schwarz, so I just talk about it in a similar way so that you can go back and you can follow it. But basically, what you can do is think, okay, well, let's consider my histogram of DEDX, okay, whatever that is. All right, a histogram, we don't think about it this way, but it's just a probability distribution. Okay? It peaks where things are more probable, and it has low spots where things are less probable. That's what a histogram is. Okay? Usually, the y-axis is number of whatever, number of events, number of photons, number, you know. But if you normalize this distribution so that its area is 1, then each of these bins is the probability to be in that bin. Okay? So the y-axis becomes the probability to be in bin dEdx, wherever I am, plus dEdx plus the bin size. Okay? Does that make sense? I want to see some nods. Does it make sense? Seriously? Okay. So, so this probability distribution says, well, if I have a pion, it will have a high probability to give this much energy. It will have a low probability to give this much and a low probability to give this much. And this much, I have a medium probability. Whatever. Okay? That's basically what this histogram is telling me. Well, we could call this, just to the term, a probability density function. Okay? So even though this is a histogram, you know, what actually looks something like this, we call it a probability density function. If the bin size is small, it's essentially a function. Okay? You tell it what bin you want to know, and you get a value. Now, imagine I have a device where I'm going to make many measurements of the ionization. Say I make 100 measurements, I don't know, whatever. So I make many measurements, and in each of those layers, I have this distribution, meaning that a pion in this layer, you know, they may be a different radii from the beam, so they may all look a little different. But for each layer, I have some known distribution, probability distribution, for a pion. Maybe I got this from test beam or something, okay? So I have this distribution, and now when I measure... Now when I measure, so this is my PDF, okay? And now I make a measurement in layer 1, and I get a value of this, okay? Now that doesn't look all that good of a match to a pion, but I may look in layer 2, so let's say this is layer 1. I may look in layer 2, and I may get a value here. I may look in layer 3, I may get a value here. So this is 2, this is 3. I may look in layer 4, and I get a value here. You get a bunch of these, okay? Some of them are consistent, some of them are not. Of course, I could have, that might be what happens if I had an actual pion. If I didn't have an actual pion, let's say I had a kaon, let's say this is the pion PDF, I may get measurements like this. Now, they all seem to not be very consistent with being a pion, okay? Well, instead of just cutting and saying, okay, this is where I say it's a pion and that's where I say it's a kaon, what I could do is I could just calculate the probability. This has got a very low probability. This is a medium probability. And I could just calculate the probability for each measurement. And that's what my little piece of pi is. So given these measurements, a sub I, these are each the a sub i's, the values that I got for each layer, and I can calculate the probability, the product of the probabilities, this is a long sentence, the product of the probabilities to be a pion given the individual ionization measurements in n layers. Okay? Does that sentence make sense? Okay? So this product... we can call an overall probability or likelihood to be a pion. It doesn't have an absolute meaning yet. It's just a number that is the product of all of these. I haven't cut on anything. There's no inefficiency. I've just picked all the measurements. If I had a bad probability in one layer, but all the other ones were good, then this is not going to have too much effect. I'm going to keep it. This looks like a pretty good pion. Here, I'm going to throw it away because, okay, this looks like no worse of a measurement than this one, but all the rest of it say, no, this is really not a pion. Okay? So now I get some probability to be a pion, given all those measurements. And then similarly, I can have a similar histogram for kaons. Okay? And I can do the same thing. I could say, well, given I have my object, my event, so I measure my A sub I's, and I figure out what the probability in each layer is to be a kaon, and I take their product, and I get an overall probability to be a kaon. Okay? So for this one event, I have one object, many measurements, and I compare it to being, basically, this is comparing it to a pion hypothesis. This is comparing it to a kaon hypothesis. So if it's a pion, I'm going to get a higher value here than here. Right? If it's a kaon, I'm going to get a higher value here than here. Okay? And what we usually do is very simple. We just take those products and we take, for instance, the pion overall probability divided by the sum of the pion plus the kaon. Now, this has a nice feature that it's always between 0 and 1. Okay? And so it's easy to compare things. But what will happen is if I have kaons, this value is going to be small, much smaller than the sum of these two values, because it's going to look like a kaon. If it's a pion, this value is going to be similar to the sum of these two, because it's not going to look much like a kaon, so this is going to be similar to this. The numerator and denominator can be close to 1. So you'll get something closer to 1. And this is, you know, every time you see a likelihood analysis, you'll just see, you know, things down near 0 or things up near 1. And now I've used all my layers, all my measurements. I haven't cut on anything. And now I could say, well, now I can cut. I could say at 0.5. Everything above 0.5 is a pion. Everything less is a kaon in this example. Okay? This is not specific to particle ID, certainly not specific to using ionization detectors for particle ID. It's used over and over and over again. And it's a way of getting better performance. You don't have the problems that you have for the truncated mean case that I described a few minutes ago. Okay? And hopefully we'll talk more about these kind of things as we go. Okay. So the last thing that I wanted to talk about today was transition radiation detectors. Cherenkov radiation works until you get into this ultra-relativistic regime. And then the Cherenkov angle stops changing because beta, the velocity, is essentially 1. So you start to run out of information. So now if you have a, 10 GeV pion and a 10 GeV electron, they both basically are traveling the speed of light. You can't tell them apart by looking at their Cherenkov angle. There is a way, but not the size of the Cherenkov angle. Okay? So you need to go to another technique, and transition radiation provides that technique because it only really happens when you get to extremely high values of gamma. So that's why we use it. And in fact, it's used in cosmic ray physics. It's used in a variety of situations because usually the detectors are pretty lightweight and they can be made to be very, very large. So what you have, as a reminder, to set up the transition radiation phenomenon, you need to have alternating dielectrics. So you may have polypropylene foils, very, very thin sheets of polypropylene, and then a gap, and then a polypropylene, and then a gap, and you may have 1,000 of those. Very, very thin. They don't take up much space, but you have this sort of high and low dielectric, on and on, off and on and off and on and off. And by having that situation, as a charged particle passes through these transitions to different dielectric, and I'm not reviewing, I'm just mentioning to just trigger back to what we talked about before. Basically, you set up a case where you can start producing very low intensity, but X-rays, photons in the X-ray region, which travel forward in the direction of the charged particle, and which can escape these foils and get into a volume afterwards, usually a gas chamber, okay? A gaseous ionization detector, okay? So this is a very crude drawing, but imagine you have a bunch of foils, many, many more than this, and then you have a gas detector here, you have a series of wires in a plane, you have an electrode here, there would be one here too, and what you have is an incident particle, and as it passes through here, it produces an X-ray, which escapes, goes into the gas region. That X-ray can cause some ionization, and then now you've got an electron traveling through the gas, and that creates its own yield of, drift electrons that can be collected. And then this particle is charged particle. It's going through a gas, so it also produces some ionization, which will then drift to these wires. So you get both things. Now, this is if you have a particle, and I should have written it to remind, you have a particle where the gamma is around 1,000 or more. Very, very, very ultra, super ultra, whatever, relativistic. Okay? Really, it's an electron in most cases. It's very hard to get to a relevant energy for any other particle. So if you have an electron, you produce these X-rays and this ionization. If you don't have an electron, you just produce the ionization. Okay. So let's actually, there's one before I get into that. It seems like something didn't get. All right. Let me backpedal for a moment. Let's go back to ionization detectors. I wanted to go over this table because it's got a lot of information on it. So this is different gas mixtures for ionization detectors. So there's sort of methane. There's noble gas detectors here. Pressure around 1 atmosphere, 2 atmospheres. This is the voltage in the gas. And then this is the full width half maximum if you just made one measurement, okay? So I wanted to put some numbers to the discussion. So you see, in general, this number goes from, say, around 30% up to somewhere around 60 or 70%. Very, very wide. And then if you do the truncated mean approach where you average the rest of the measurements, so you now have several measurements, you get to something that's down to a few percent, okay? So this is a huge improvement, but you'll also notice that there are some variations in these numbers. So these are noble gases with some admixture, and then these are just hydrocarbons, pure hydrocarbons. And what you can look at is this is the actual size of the relativistic rise. So this is the DEDX at the Fermi plateau, okay, divided by the DEDX of minimum ionization. Okay? So this is the total size of the relativistic rise. And the largest number is about 1.5 here. It can be a little bit larger, but it's about 1.5. The smallest is about 1.1, not very big. Okay? So the hydrocarbons are generally giving you a smaller relativistic rise than these noble gas cases, all right? However, that's not the only story, because in this case, the noble gases also have a wider distribution, okay? So the measurements are not as good, but the variation is larger, so you may be able to do it. So what really matters is to compare the size of the variation D to the resolution. So this D over sigma I mentioned. I should have mentioned at the beginning. So taking two cases, the electron and pion and pion and proton, you see that for electron and pion, you're getting, for most of these, between 2 and 4 times the resolution. Okay? 2 is kind of marginal, but okay, you can see a difference between an electron and a pion. You can compare a pion and a proton, it's a bigger mass difference, therefore a bigger difference in ionization. And now you get things between about 4 and 7. Okay, so this is a much easier to detect difference. But what you also notice is that these numbers are not all that different than these numbers. These are a little less than 2. These are a little greater than 2. But that sort of this advantage in the relativistic rise's size, you lose some of that because the resolution isn't as good. So it really matters what this d over sigma is, not just d and not just sigma. Okay? So I wanted to make that point, and that's not just for this kind of detector. That's a point in general. Whenever you're making these measurements, it really matters not just how big the measurement is or the variation, but also the size of the resolution. All right, back to the transition radiation case. I'll just say a few points today, and we'll pick this up on Thursday. So it turns out Gruppen and Schwartz spent the whole section basically on the Atlas TRT, so I might as well just go with it. So in this case, you have about 370,000 of these straw tubes. We talked about these before. So they're made out of some sort of plastic or you know, in this case, Kapton. So they're long cylinders, literally about the size of a thick straw. And kind of very much in the case of drift tube device we talked about before, you know, they have an anode wire. And then on the inside of this foil, of this tube, is a conductive film. So that makes this a cathode. The inner wall of this thing is a cathode. And this wire is an anode, and it's about 30 microns wide. It's gold-plated tungsten, and it's a drift tube, okay? And then in between these, and I need to dig up a good picture, but there's polypropylene foils as the transition radiation radiator, okay? So it's a more complicated version of what we had here. You've really got sort of these things are all very much intermixed. The gas is 70%, 27%, and 3% of xenon, carbon dioxide, and oxygen. And the important point about this is really just that it absorbs X-rays very well. So the straw tubes are small, but you still absorb the transition radiation X-rays, and that matters because you don't produce that many transition radiation photons. And then as a tracker, this has the advantage that this is a drift tube. So you measure in that drift tube the distance perpendicular to the anode by the drift time. Very much like, well, we already used this straw tube example to talk about the straw tubes alone. But so now you've got a transition radiation measurement as well as a tracking measurement. So how's the particle ID done? Well, the transition radiation in this case is depositing something close to 10 keV of energy, okay, into a transition radiation photon or photons. The minimum ionization, so it's just dEdx in this gas, is about 2 keV. So this is certainly bigger than this, but you're, as we said, if you have an electron, you're getting both of these. If you have a pion, you only get this one. You don't get no energy, even though you don't have transition radiation. So you could pick a threshold that says, you know, maybe it's above 5 keV or whatever, but you pick a threshold such that most pions will fail and most electrons will pass. And I think I have a diagram of what this looks like. Well, okay, before I get to that. This is a diagram of the number of clusters. It's related to the number of photons produced, transition radiation photons, for an electron passing through a transition radiation detector. And this is gamma, the relativistic gamma. And this is when there's no radiator, there's no dielectric alternating back and forth. And you just get some amount of, you know, detections that's relatively flat. And then when you put the foils in, right around a gamma of 1,000 or a little bit before that, you see it starts to really take off. Okay? And this is a distribution of the energy losses observed for pions and electrons. I think this is 50 GeV, but I don't recall. This is from one straw tube. So again, you're actually in a situation where you're going to make many measurements with many straw tubes, even just of the DEDX. But you can see that the pions are about a quarter of the electrons, and that makes sense given the 2 keV and the 10 keV energy loss that I mentioned for the two components. So you could separate these. If you go through and use the straw tube measurements, you have many straw tube measurements, you can construct a variable from them that will discriminate electrons and pions. And this is showing you the pion efficiency versus the electron efficiency. Now, you notice the pion efficiency is small, 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. So I'm not keeping very many pions. But my electron efficiency is very high, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9. So I'm keeping most of my electrons. Okay? And then it's just a question of where